shadows in the dark.
The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
And if the hippies and the yippies and the disruptors of the systems will shut up,
demented spiritual experience.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley.
Okay, we've had a problem here.
P is equal MC squared.
The message is very simple. Think for yourself and question authority.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Shadows in the Dark. I am your host, Jeremiah Greer, and tonight we have a fantastic show lined up for you. We are going to be speaking with Dina Budd during the first hour about her latest book, The Wiser Field Guide to Cryptozoology. So if you're a cryptozoology fan out there, it will be the hour for you. We're going to be talking about werewolves, dragons, skyfish, lizard men, and other fascinating creatures, real and mysterious. So always interesting topic there. And during the last 2 hours, we're going to be talking with Gordon Strong about Merlin, Master of Magic. So I'm sure most everybody out there has heard of Merlin the Magician in some form or another, whether it was through a Disney cartoon or you actually studied up on the mythical person themselves. Mythical, myth, you know, some say historical. I don't know. We'll find out the answers to that here in just a few. But I tell you, I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a great show. We're going to have a lot of fun tonight. Two guests. I'm really liking the new format we've been kind of putting on here lately. And, of course, I want to thank those who have already joined us in the chat room as well. So thanks to you all. If you are not in the chat room but you are tuned in live, well, it's very easy to find. Just go to tenacityradio.com, click on the Listen Live link in the menu at the top, and bam, slam, it'll drop you right into the chat room. How'd you like that? Bam, slam. That was just right off the top of my head. That's just kind of the creativity you get right here with Shadows in the Dark. No. Well, we just like to have a little bit of fun. But I tell you what, if you haven't checked out that new website of ours, oh, please do so, sitdradio.com. We launched that just a couple weeks ago, or maybe last week, something like that, not too long ago. And I tell you what, I really, really am enjoying it. Thank you again to Amanda for all the hard work she put into it. There is some more to come to that website as we continue finishing it up, putting the final touches, a little bit of tweaks, a little bit of spit and shine right there on top of it. Of course, you can still vote for the Camper Studios. Many of you know, if you've been listening to the show for the last few months, we are now in a camper studio out in the backyard, more or less. So we put a contest out there for you to help us name the studio. And it's very simple. Just go to the website. You'll scroll down there. Again, that's sitdradio.com. You'll see a picture of a camper. And just click on that little read more link and read kind of what it's all about. It's pretty simple. All you need to do is put your name, email address, and your entry name. And if you want to explain why you were picking that name, please do so. Because, I mean, we really want to know that the name has some kind of meaning to it. We don't want to just slap a name on it. We want the name to kind of have some kind of meaning to go along with it. So we gave you an area to explain exactly what the meaning is behind the name. Now, this is a contest, so you do have a chance of winning 3 Shadows in the Dark t-shirts. That is the logo t-shirt, the gray t-shirt. That is also the 2009 24-hour bash t-shirt, as well as the 2010. Now, we put the 24-hour bash on for 3 years, but we don't have any more 2008 t-shirts left. There was actually very, very little of those made. I think, matter of fact, maybe only about 30 something, and we gave away one every hour, all kinds of stuff. So they went quick, but you can get a chance to win those 3 t-shirts. It's pretty simple how to take place. We'll actually have a group of judges. We'll look at the names. We'll decide what is the favorite of all those judges, put all those favorites in a hat, draw out only one, and that will be the official name for the temporary camper. So keep that in mind as you do your name. This is this is not a permanent studio for us. We just kind of were able to move it out of the house, make it a little bit quieter in there for those who are trying to sleep and whatnot. Anyone who's around me knows my voice is kind of loud and tends to carry long distance. I think I had the other day someone from about 30 miles down the road call me wanting to know what my question was again, if I could please repeat it. But yeah, so please take part in that. Of course, Talking Thoughts, we'll do our Talking Thoughts tonight. If you haven't done it yet, let's see where we kind of stand. If you go to SITDradio.com, right below the Camper Studio Contest, you will see Talking Thoughts. It's you'll see a picture of an alien holding a little sign that says Talking Thoughts. And when you click on that, you can vote on the subject change. You know, I really don't know how to explain this. This is a way for the listeners to really take control of the show for 15 minutes or so. And what will happen is at 10:45, well, at 10:40, we'll look to see what vote has the most, or what subject matter has the most votes. And then at 10:45 p.m., we will completely change the subject, no matter what we're talking about, to discuss Talking Thoughts, which will take us up to the top of the hour, and then we'll come back and continue on with our normal programming. So that is Talking Thoughts, SITDradio.com. It looks like right now we have a tie. We've only got a couple of votes. The Power of the Mind and Humans, the Smarter Species, is what has been voted on so far. So if you haven't taken that vote, please, please do. I think I already have, so I'm not going to vote again. I'd hate to do that and throw everything for a kink there. But again, that's SITDradio.com. So, as a matter of fact, let's type that out in the chat room for all those who are in the chat room, and then you can, if I could spell right, and that way you can click on it if you will. If you haven't voted, please, please do. But, well, enough of that. Enough of the kind of the business stuff out of the way there. Like I said, we're going to have a great show tonight. That first hour guest, again, is Dina Budd. We're going to be talking about cryptozoology. She has the book, The Wiser's Field Guide to Cryptozoology. And then during the last 2 hours, we will be talking about Merlin the Magician. And that will be with Gordon Strong, who wrote the book Merlin, Master of Magic, which I have got to actually read the book. I tell you what, I'm really looking forward to this interview because it goes way beyond Merlin. At least this book does, goes way beyond Merlin, and it talks a lot about the magic that surrounded him, the folklore, the myths, the legends, the historical side. I mean, it's really, for such a small book, I tell you, it's got a lot of information in it. But let's take a quick little break. When we return, we'll be talking cryptozoology with Dina Budd. Well, our first guest tonight, like I said, is Dina Budd. She is the author of The Wiser's Field Guide to Cryptozoology, as well as the paranormal editor for Bella Online. It's an online magazine at bellaonline.com. Dina, how are you today?
Hey, I'm great. How are you doing, Jeremiah?
I tell you, I'm doing just fine. And I, you know, I have to ask, I've always, you know, co-editor, assistant editor, never paranormal editor. So what makes that a little bit different of a title?
I'm sorry, what makes that a little bit different?
Yeah, I mean, you know, paranormal editor. I've never seen anybody have the title like that in publication. So was it, which is kind of a creative thing is all it was, or, I mean, obviously you focus on paranormal phenomenon, I would say.
Right, right. I've been doing this for a little over 2 years. That's actually how I came to write the book. I had started, writing articles for this site, and I was contacted by the publishing company asking me if I would be interested in writing a book on Skyfish, which is the first chapter in my book. There really wasn't enough information to write an entire book on that, so they asked me if I would write a book on cryptozoology, and that's how all that got started.
Now, so have you done a lot of research or work in cryptozoology, or was this kind of an opportunity for you to learn more about that field?
That's exactly right. That's a wonderful question. It was a great opportunity. I hadn't done a lot of research in that area. I mean, the paranormal just encompasses so many areas, and I've been interested in the paranormal since I was a kid. I don't know, you're probably too young to remember Dark Shadows with Barnabas Collins, and I would rush home after school every day and watch that show. And then I used to do seances and use the Ouija board and that kind of thing when I was a kid, and I just always loved this sort of thing. I've had very weird experiences happened to me throughout my life, and it just seemed kind of a natural thing for me to start writing articles related to the paranormal. And so I did have to do quite a bit of research. I spent more time on the research, actually, than the actual writing of the book, because I had so much to do in that sense. I, you know, and I have lots and lots of books. I have over 2,500 books, and so I had many of my own references to go to, and then I did a lot of research online, and I contacted people that are experts in this field, and I used all of that information to write the book.
Oh, so over 2,500 books in your library. Now, what kind of books would you see in the Dina Budd Library?
Well, a lot of them are biographies. A lot have to do with horror. I have every book written by Stephen King and by Dean Koontz because they're my favorite authors. And a lot of nonfiction, a lot of reference books. I have lots and lots of reference books. You know, when I was younger, I didn't collect them so much as fiction. But as I've gotten older, I like research so much. It's so enjoyable to me. So a lot of my books have to do with my research.
Now, were you like that when you were a kid in school, or did the love for research come afterwards when you realized, well, I can research anything I want to?
Well, you know, it's just amazing being able to get online and research at any time of the day or night. You don't have to go to the library or even, you know, to my own library. I can go online and research anything. It's absolutely fascinating. Kind of a side story here. When I... years ago, I had found a friend of mine who had passed away, and this was probably 16 years ago. Well, that night, I got my old Ouija board out and decided to use it and try to contact him because I had just, you know, it just happened. And sure enough, he was right there. It was the most amazing thing. I mean, I had used the Ouija board as a kid. It was kind of a fun thing. Nothing really serious happened. But I'm telling you, my friend was right there all night long, hour after hour. He was talking with me, communicating with me. It was him. It was his sense of humor. He knew things that only he could know. It was just amazing. Well, the next night when I tried to contact him again, I guess he had moved on, and something else was there, and it kept saying Zozo and all this crazy, scary stuff. And I went online 15, 16 years ago and tried to research this Zozo. There was absolutely nothing online to do with him, nothing. I could find nothing. Well, years later, my daughter grew up, became a teenager. She went and bought her own Ouija board. And scarily, Zozo was right there waiting for her and kept saying that her mother had opened a door that she shouldn't have opened and some scary things like that. Well, at that time, I went on again online to research Zozo, and it's everywhere. Everyone is talking about Zozo. He's called the demon of the Ouija board. But it scared my daughter so much that she went and talked to a Catholic priest here in town about it, and we're not Catholic, but, you know, it was a very scary experience. It really was.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Now, I'll tell you, I want to get into a little bit more, maybe a little later, of some of your own experiences, because I always find those fascinating. See what you know brings people into researching this kind of stuff out, because a lot of times it does come from some kind of personal experience or you know, something that happened at a younger age too. I know for me, you know, my first experience with the paranormal, the unexplained, or you know, whichever you want to stick it under, you know, came at around 10 years old. And
really?
I'll never forget it, that's for sure. But let's get a little bit into the Weiser's Field Guide to Cryptozoology. Now, I tell you, I'm a huge fan of these Weiser's Field Guides, because this is not the only one. There's to vampires, to... It's like a whole little series they have going out there. And it is a nice little companion book for those who need, you know, who want to see, you know, kind of a little bit of some of what's out there, you know.
Yeah.
So tell me now, the cryptozoology one, were there specific ones that you had to kind of look into, or was this kind of something you were able to say, okay, well, that sounds like that's interesting. Let's look into that and see if I can build a little bit of a story for the book.
Well, I was very open to writing about cryptozoology. I think it's a fascinating field. I would have been happy, though, to write about any field in the paranormal, actually.
Right.
But, you know, I learned so much in my research. It was amazing what I learned. And so many of these creatures have been sighted by so many reputable people. I had no idea that they've been sighted all over the world by, you know, by police officers and not just the, you know, just the everyday person, by professional people in the community who are, you know, who you trust, who you hope wouldn't just make these things up. So I came to believe in most of these creatures.
Now, what is there about 40 or so that is in the book?
Yes, I mean there are many, many more, and I had a difficult time trying to choose the 40 I wanted to include, but there are 40 in my book. Yes.
Yeah, I bet so. Now, of course, you've got the Beast of Bladenboro, North Carolina, which is it's a few hours away. But I remember when this story kind of. If it's the one that I'm definitely thinking of, because they also called it the Beast of, what was it? Was it the Beast of Battleboro or?
The Beast of Bolivia?
Bolivia, yes, the Beast of Bolivia.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, is this kind of along the same lines, the same beast?
Yes, it's the same beast.
That's what it's
called by two different names, yes. Kind of a vampire cryptid.
Right.
Yeah, that was a very interesting one. It killed lots of animals in the 1950s, lots of livestock in a 200-mile range.
Mm-hmm. How? I mean, is it still being sighted today?
Well, not so much. You know, everybody, on any creature, you know, every once in a while you'll hear a sighting, and then they'll think that it might be the same creature that was seen many years ago, but you don't really know that's the case. And really, this one has not been seen since the 1950s.
Mm. Now, of course, they made a festival out of it, the Beast Fest.
Right? Yeah. They're doing that with a lot of different cryptids, you know.
you're right. You've got all kinds of festivals, conventions that. You know, our base, you know, or the Bigfoot conferences, they're all over the place. So I guess Beast Fest. I might have to make it out to Beast Fest sometime.
Right, that would be fun, yes.
That would. Now, there was one I was, let me see if I can find it again here, that I was really kind of interested in knowing a little bit more about. Well, let me start with this. What, you know, out of all the 40 that were in the book, which one did you find to honestly be more believable, to say, wow, you know, that this could quite possibly be a true creature that's out there? I mean, you know, that you can say that for a lot of cryptids for sure, but was there one that really stuck out?
Well, the skyfish one is the one that fascinated me the most, because I remember years ago, I saw the part, just very short part about on TV about the skyfish, and it fascinated me. And it was at a time when you couldn't research on the internet, so I couldn't find out anything more about the skyfish until you know, many, many years later. And they just fascinated me. Actually, I'm going to be going to Joplin, Missouri, at the end of July to see some skyfish. This guy has all the great equipment, and he does it all the time, and it's going to be wonderful. I'm looking forward to it a lot.
Well, can you explain skyfish exactly?
Well, they're creatures that are said to undulate through the sky all around us, too fast to be perceived by the human eye. They range in size anywhere from just a couple of inches to up to 100 feet in length. And even in the movie Braveheart with Mel Gibson, there was one that you can see back behind him. But actually, Jose Escamillo discovered these creatures in the 1990s when he was filming a documentary in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And then he started looking for these creatures in other films and started noticing them. And you might be able to look at your own videotapes and see some skyfish in there yourself.
Right, and most people know these as rods.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Most people will recognize them by the name rods.
Right, rods, skyfish, flying snakes, yes. Mm-hmm. All different names, uh-huh.
Yeah, now what do you think of them exactly? Your own personal opinion from what kind of research you've done? Because, you know, I've seen a lot of footage of this, you know, rod, skyfish, and they are very interesting. I mean, these things look like they're kind of spiraling. Well, I guess there's different ones. Some spiral, some you can see like little wings on them, but I mean, they're extremely fast.
Yes, yes, they're too fast normally to be perceived by the human eye, but I think that they exist. I really believe in these creatures. There's just been too much evidence of them. And there's, I guess, three different kinds. I'm not exactly sure if I need to find out more about them at the end of the month when I go to Joplin. But I don't know if I'll be seeing all three kinds or just you know, there's the centipede with the wings, the fins. I think those are the most common. And then there are the white rods, which have ribbons. They're no fins at all. And then, of course, there's the spears also, and they're supposed to be the fastest of them all.
Right. Now, what about historical significance on rods? What did you find in your research with it? How far back does it go of sightings of these?
Well, I believe Jose Escamillo found some films with them back to a 1910 sporting event.
Oh, wow.
That's as far back as I know about, but... yeah, that's pretty cool. 1910 sporting event.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good ways off.
You know, you had asked me about the beast of Bolivia a little bit earlier,
uh-huh.
And I did want to say that I do believe in the fall of 2007 in Lexington, North Carolina, there were, 50 or 60 goats that were found murdered and drained of all their blood. And that is exactly what the beast of Bolivia or the beast of Blaineboro would be doing. So it's possible that, you know, there are still some of these beasts around that area. And I could be wrong about the fact that there, you know, aren't any in that area anymore.
Well, yeah, I know when that came up about the goats, I thought some guy's dog had been attacked.
Yeah, pit bull, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. It was a pit bull, but they didn't see what exactly attacked it. So, you know, they didn't say, but of course stories of the beast of Bolivia is what started coming out again when that happened.
Right.
So I thought it was really
awesome.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, talking about, you know, sucking the blood from goats and stuff, I mean, to me it sounds more like a chupacabra.
Yes, and you know, so many of, I found in so many cases with these creatures that they do kind of overlap quite often.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, I thought you was still kind of going there. I'm sorry. What about, let me pick another one out here, just hear a little bit about, well, of course, dragons. You know, I mean, that's an icon in so much, in so many different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
What did you include in the book on dragons?
Well, actually, my chapter on dragons is mainly about the Komodo dragons. You know,
okay.
They are huge. You know.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't want to mess with one.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, I did mention that you know, many years ago there were huge creatures that probably were related to the dragons, like in Australia, in places. I'm not certain in the United States that there's ever been any evidence of dragons ever having been here, but I think in New South Wales and places like that, there's evidence that dragons once reigned in those areas.
Mm. Now, I gotta kind of, when you look and talking about, you know, overlapping, right? You know, some of these creatures tend to overlap, and characteristics are. You know, descriptions, you know, what about, you know, do you feel that some of these reported creatures are, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, not really figments of our imagination, but maybe ways of, you know, compiling our fears into something, you know, it kind of made me think, it's like the Ohio grass man, you know, I mean, someone that looks like grass, you know, you hear about, you know, the lizard man, you know, how much do you think is, you know, let me put it this way. How much do you think is, you know, legend and some of that just kind of our own fears?
Well, I really think that the Ohio grassman is probably just another version of Bigfoot. You know,
right.
Bigfoot's been spotted for so many years by so many different people. And I just feel that that's probably just another version of Bigfoot. But like, for instance, the Encantados, the dolphin men of Brazil, and the Cluricons, which are a type of leprechauns that guard the wine in their cellars, I don't believe that they probably exist. I think that I thought they were fun to research. I wanted to include them just kind of for fun.
Right.
But, you know, I don't believe that the dolphin men of Brazil exist.
Now, what are the dolphin men of Brazil? And what leads you to believe that these are just legend?
Well, the dolphin men of Brazil, you know, I love the water, so creatures to do with the water especially interest me. But these are creatures, well, encantado in Portuguese means enchanted or delighted, and it, you know, it's just such a fun creature. They're said to live in the Amazon River, and these encantados, they love to love. They love to party, and they come out of the water, and they find parties to attend, and they have all kinds of fun. Sometimes they want to take people back with them. You know, they fall in love with a human being, and they might kidnap the object of their affection and take them under the water and have hybrid children born from these. From these unions. That's the legend anyway. But I guess in Brazil, parents, they warn their children, their daughters at carnival time to not to go off with charming strangers. And you're not even supposed to make eye contact with an encantado for very long because you might become under their spell.
Right. See, now for me, you know, a lot of that sounds like an old folk story to keep the children in line. You know?
Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But, and you know, that's going to be a mix out there, you know, with some of the, you know, real stories. There's got to be a mix of those old folk tales that were passed down from generation to generation, you know, just like say, don't go walking off with the, you know, the charming stranger.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's something you don't want your kids to do unless that charming stranger has lots of money and it's going to give it to the parents. Then it's okay. No. let's go through another one here. I was kind of flipping through. I've got the book right here for me. Now, where is it exactly available at?
I'm sorry, what?
The book, The Wiser's Field Guide to Cryptozoology. Where can it be found at?
Oh, I'm sorry. It can be found at anywhere books are sold. Also on Amazon. You know, you can order it from Amazon and any Barnes and Noble store, any bookstore, actually. Borders, any of those.
Oh, okay.
And if they don't carry it, they would be able to order it.
Right.
They should be carrying it, though.
Let's hope so. I tell you, they look really nice. I mean, the whole series of the Wiser's Field Guides, they look really nice. It is a very nice little series that Wiser's got going on there. Now, I wanted to ask you, talking about the, and please correct me if I pronounce this wrong, the Cluricons?
Yes, the Cluricons, uh-huh.
Cluricons. That sounds like something from Star Trek or something. The Cluricons. Now, you're talking about kind of being like, you know, kind of a relative or kind of like a leprechaun. And it was a while back. I was watching a little series on leprechauns. And one of the most interesting things that I learned from that was that if you see a leprechaun on your property, are on some property, that the government will actually come in and deem that property not protected because there was a leprechaun sighting on it. Have you heard this before?
No, I had not. That's very interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was something, because this guy was talking about this tract of land that was his. He spotted a leprechaun on it, and the government came in and deemed it protected. And I thought, wow, that's... You know, that's amazing. For a government to go that far.
Right, yes. Wow, no, I did not know about that. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, I mean, it's just hard to even imagine a government taking that kind of step. I mean, it's like, I mean, imagine what would happen if a government came up and said, well, we're protecting this forest because Bigfoot was sighted in there. Yeah, people would say, what are you talking about? You're crazy. But yet, you know, Ireland does this. They protect land that, and it's just a sighting. It doesn't have to be that a leprechaun was photographed there or there was a huge group of people. I mean, one person can sight it, and if they feel like it needs to be deemed protected because of that, they will.
That is so cool. Wow, I had not heard that. That is amazing. I love that.
I thought it was something else. I mean, just it floored me. Now let's look at another cryptid you got going on in here. Of course, one I'm sure a lot of people don't want to hear about, and that's giant spiders. What kind of stories of giant spiders have you heard or collected or researched out for the book?
Well, you know, the first story I heard about giant spiders was when my son came back from Iraq.
Right.
Told me about Oh, man. He said it was as big as a dinner plate. It was huge. And he was working in his office, and he had the door open because it was rather warm, and this creature just, big spider just sat there and looked at him, and it kind of lifted its front legs. And my son, he started freaking out. He started throwing water bottles and the phone and the scanner, and he was yelling, "Get away from me, you freaking demon." he really wanted to come home. He hated those big old giant camel spiders.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, you know, I'm not afraid of spiders. I think they're really amazing creatures. But yeah, you start adding some size to them, then
right.
it's a different story. You know, I mean, you know, a fly is all harmless until it's 10 feet tall.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I love spiders too. I don't kill spiders in my house. You know,
neither,
I'll rescue them and take them outside. You know, but. One that big, a big old spider, I wouldn't want to encounter at all.
All right, well, see, now, well, I'm glad to hear that. Now I have somebody who's not as, my family looks at me crazy when they go to kill a spider. I'm like, no, or even a fly. They're going to kill a fly.
Oh, I know.
And I'm like, no, don't kill the fly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, you know, I catch them and, you know, release it outside. And they're, you know, everybody looks at me like I'm crazy. We had these two ants that honestly walked around the countertops for weeks because I wouldn't let anybody kill them. And they finally went on about their business, you know, after a while.
Right, yes. No, I'm the same way. I totally understand that. I do. But, and everyone thinks I'm crazy too, but I'm the one that they come to when there's a spider that's, you know, in the house or in the office or wherever.
Right, yeah. Catch this.
And even bats, you know, I'm the one, oh my goodness, I've had so many encounters with bats. One day, I had a long skirt on, and I was walking by a restaurant, and a bat flew out of that restaurant and flew up my skirt. Oh my goodness, yes. And the lady who ran the restaurant, she came running out, and she was, you know, she was so scared because she thought that, you know, anybody else would freak out. But I happen to be a person that loves bats. I've got one tattoo on me, and it's a vampire bat, the only tattoo I have. And so I took the bat, you know, and I had her get a box, and I rescued that bat, and I took it up to some caves up behind where I live, and I trudged through the river with this box and this bat, and walked up through the hills, through the trees. It took me a good hour to get up to these caves, and I forgot my flashlight, so I couldn't go very far back. But I rescued the bat, so I felt real proud of myself.
that is a funny story.
It's just always happening. My daughter called me one time. There was a bat downtown. The lady running a little store downtown had her broom, and she was very frightened of this bat, and she was trying to kill it with her broom, you know. My daughter said, "You better get down here and save this bat." And yeah, the lady tried to attack me with the broom when I was trying to save the bat. I had to wrestle that broom away from her. She went a little crazy.
Well, I tell you what, Dina, it sounds like you're out there rescuing about every creature known to man.
Well, I don't know. You know, I do love nature, and creatures that that are a little different are people are afraid of them. And, you know, I guess I can relate to that because I was always a little bit different. My interests have always been a little bit different than most people. So I guess I relate to that.
Well, I know, like, even for me, even a tick. You know, I love watching a tick crawl around. I don't know why.
You're kidding.
It's like this little headless creature, you know. It's...
Wow. I don't like ticks. I mean, I love it. Around here, I don't know if you have morel mushrooms there, but people go mushroom hunting in April and May. Well, there's a two-week period. It depends on how much rain we get. And, oh, my goodness, you know, these mushrooms are, people do not tell where they find their mushrooms. This is a big, big deal.
Oh, yeah.
And I have had to quit going because... there are so many ticks, and I'm telling you, every time you go mushroom hunting, you'll come home with 7, 8, 9 ticks on you. And I just, you know, with Lyme disease so prevalent anymore, it's just, I kind of have to wait till the fall before I get to go back in the woods and go too late for mushrooms then. But it's a shame that it's like that, but every year there's more and more ticks. I don't know why, and I don't like ticks.
Now, I won't leave one hanging on me for a couple weeks, but... You know, I will set them down and watch them crawl around a bit. you know, get a good laugh. Now, I tell you, we're getting into bugs here. We're supposed to be talking cryptozoology, but have you ever seen? We have these little bugs that they get in the studio here quite a bit, and they're such fun to watch. I call them pop bugs. I do not have any idea what their real names are, but they're kind of a real slender football shape, and they have basically like. The exoskeleton is in two pieces, one longer for the bottom and then a top one.
Right.
But if you flip them over, they somehow, they use those two pieces of exoskeleton to pop and flip themselves back over. And I've seen them, they'll pop, depending on the size of the bug, they'll pop like a foot or a foot and a half in the air. And land back down on their feet and then just continue to walk on. That's why we call them pop bugs.
That is amazing. Yeah, I would like to see those little bugs. I don't think I've ever seen bugs like that before.
they are so much fun to watch. We're going to, next time one's walking around, I'm going to get out the video camera and watch everybody be cruel. Watch me be cruel to this bug and turn them upside down like 50 times so we can watch them pop back over. but they're so cool to watch. But that's, you know, there's a fascination in nature. And, you know, I guess if we want to tie it back into cryptozoology, that is part of that fascination of what is out there in nature. What are the things that we don't know about? And, you know, it can be, you know, over the whole world or even regional or, you know, whatever the case may be. It's just, there's so much out there.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And I just love mysteries. And I'm so glad that even with all of our technology and all of our investigating and exploring, there are still so many more mysteries. You know, I just love that.
Mm. Do you think we'll ever, at some point, who knows, you know, 10 years from now or 5,000 years from now, there will be no reason to have, say, a talk show like this one because there are no mysteries?
No, there's got to always be mysteries.
we don't want to think along those lines. You know, it's always my, you know, once you kind of, I guess understand one mystery, it kind of opens the door to many others because there's other pieces to it. You know, let's say, oh, Bigfoot does exist. Okay, now where did Bigfoot come from? What is the
right.
Bigfoot culture like? You know, there's a lot more questions that it can potentially open up, really.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, man. I discover that in every week when I do my paranormal research for my articles and in writing this book, you know, one door opens another door and you go off on another tangent and another tangent. And you find another mystery. And before you know it, you're way, way down the road from where you began. And you have to go back because, you know, originally that's what you were supposed to be writing about. But then you find 10 other things you want to write about just from exploring and investigating and researching this one thing. No, it just, yeah, you're right. It opens so many doors.
Yeah, it really does. And I definitely agree with you. I don't want to see the mysteries, you know, ever disappear because, you know, number one, I wouldn't have nothing to do on Sunday nights. you know, so, you know, I don't know. I would be lost. I would just have to sit in the middle of a field and just do nothing then.
It wouldn't be any fun at all, would it?
It really, really wouldn't. now, what is your all-time favorite cryptid?
Well, I love the rods, you know, like I said before, I love the rods. But I've always been a big fan of vampires. I love vampires. I've always loved vampires, all my life. And my daughter went through a phase where she was a little depressed because she couldn't be a vampire.
Oh, really?
Yes. You know, they are fascinating. They've got, you know, they're strong and they're romantic and they go out at night and they can mesmerize people and they can fly. They can turn into bats and fly. I think that was the main thing that she really liked. I mean, she wanted to be able to fly.
All right.
I thought it would be neat to, I mean, of all the creatures, you know, back in the day when I was a kid, you know, it was either the werewolf or zombies or the vampires or Frankenstein, you know, and I always thought vampires were the coolest.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do have such a romantic allure or romantic kind of, I don't know the best way to describe it, but, you know, especially now, I mean, look at the vampire movies and TV shows over the last year. It's just, it's been insane, you know, one after another. And, you know, right now you see, you know, vampire images, stories all over the place. And a lot of people are really interested in it.
Yeah. I love it too. I love that the series True Blood. I think that's a great, great series. Do you ever watch that?
I watched some of it. I think my mom got hooked on that, to be honest, and she sat there and watched every, I think it was like the entire first season or something, episode by episode, over like 2 or 3 days. So I kind of watched it along with her. It was really neat.
Uh-huh.
And what was, you know, one of the things that we see, you know, what you see in the way that vampires are portrayed in a lot of movies and TV shows now compared to some of the older ones is, you know, they have an everyday life. They run bars. They have jobs. They got to worry about, you know, this and that while being a vampire or, and with True Blood, I mean, what they even had shapeshifters and a few other things in there too, didn't they?
Right. Yes. Yes.
Now, do you think that, you know, the way that they are portraying vampires nowadays really helps increase that interest into them? Because now you can kind of associate with, well, not only does he suck blood, but he's also got his light bill he's got to pay by the end of the month. You know, that's really kind of what's going on now.
You're right. I do not. I have no idea why they're so popular at this time. You know, I my daughter, she loved Interview with the Vampire, and that's what started her interest. And it just seems like since then, they've just become increasingly popular. But they've always been, people have always loved vampires. You know, like I said, Dark Shadows, Barnabas Collins, I mean, they still to this day have, every year they have I can't think of the word. They get together, their gatherings every year on either the East Coast or the West Coast, and all the fans from all those many years ago, you know, go to these gatherings, and it's just amazing, you know. People that are, you know, in their 60s and 70s now are still into these vampires from Dark Shadows.
Yeah, it's something else. And it is, like I said, to me it's been a fascination of you know, how they've portrayed him. I mean, I'm waiting for the one to come out where literally it's a middle-aged vampire. He's got like 4 kids. You know, he's trying to work 3 jobs to pay the bills, you know, while going out at night to find the blood to keep himself alive. That's the TV series I'm waiting for.
Wow.
Now I've got a question from the chat room, from Captain Bugface in our chat room. He is asking, What is your definition of a cryptid?
Well, a cryptid, I believe, is a creature not proven by science to exist.
Okay, now, and I guess, too, because I know where he's coming from with this. What would you define as a creature? Because like a vampire, many don't put vampires kind of under cryptozoology, but we've kind of talked a little bit tonight as if, you know, you kind of put it under that category. So you see a vampire as a creature more than, I guess, an extension of the human dead soul?
Well, you know, that's interesting that you would ask that because, that was very difficult for me to determine because, you know, many cryptozoologists have different opinions on what cryptozoology encompasses. You know, many people include the vampires and the werewolves and zombies and such. Other people include fairies and dragons, doppelgangers and shadow people and black dogs. And some people only feel like, you know, it's the hairy humanoids and the giants and the chupacabra. Other people include aliens in with it. So, you know, that was difficult for me to try to figure out exactly what creatures I wanted to include in my book. But I'm very open-minded, and I thought, you know, the more creatures you include under this category, the more you have to talk about.
Right. And what you did include shadow people in
the book.
Yes,
I did. I did. You know, I don't know that I necessarily felt like, I don't know that I necessarily feel that they are cryptids, but I think they're interesting, so I included them. I mean, other people, other cryptozoologists, the experts, if, you know, if they want to include shadow people, then I could include it in my field guide. That's okay with me.
Right. Well, you know, we've had cryptozoologists on in the past, and I remember one explaining it to us that there were basically, and I'm not going to remember them all, but there was, I think it was five criteria that she went by to define something as a cryptid. And it wasn't, uh-huh. It wasn't just, well, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, you know, these mythical creatures that have never been proven to exist. It was even, you included, you know, animals that are known to exist, but they're being spotted out of their normal, habitat.
Right.
But yet not proven to exist in that habit, in this new habitat. Mm-hmm. And a perfect example is the jaguarundi, which is a known creature, mainly kind of, I think, in Mexico around there, but they're getting a lot of sightings in Florida and kind of down, that coast all the way up around to Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with that. Also, some people include creatures or cryptids that are not in their time era. They were thought extinct. Now they're being seen again. You know, some cryptozoologists actually include creatures such as that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really fascinating subject, and there is so much that can really be involved in. And I think some people realize, because you know we are kind of. You know, I didn't want to say controlled by the media or anything, but that's what, you know, is focused on in the media, in, you know, magazines, radio shows. You know, it's Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, which even Loch Ness Monster has kind of fell out of the limelight.
Yeah, you're right. You don't hear much about the Loch Ness Monster at all anymore.
Yeah, I know. Poor Nessie's dead, I guess. I don't know.
Oh.
Well, I won't say it to be mean, but, you know, I mean, just, you know, like I say, it's been quite some time since any kind of real Loch Ness, and I've never liked calling it monster, but, you know, Loch Ness Monster story has kind of been around. But, I mean, there's Bigfoot, Chupacabra, you know, some of these, you know, well-known creatures in cryptozoology. I mean, you're still getting sightings all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what do you think, I mean, with Nessie, why do you feel that that's kind of gone away? Do you think that I don't know, that imagination is kind of lacking anymore? I mean, because there was really no really, really good sighting of Nessie.
I can't explain that. I don't know why people aren't seeing Nessie, you know. I'd like to go over there and kind of explore and maybe try to come up with an answer to that, but I don't know what to tell you. That's a good question.
Well, I tell you what, if you go over there, let me know. We'll go together and we'll dive around in the lock.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said, let me know if you go over there. We'll go over there together and we'll take a dive into the lock.
That would be fun. I would do that.
I know. I would swim around, even though, what is it? You can't really see that. It's real murky, right?
I think so, yeah.
see, my luck. Now, let me tell you, Dina, this is my luck, because you even mentioned this in the book, and which there's stories of these not too far from me as it is. My luck, I would dive into the lock looking for Nessie, and I would get eaten by a giant catfish.
Are there giant catfish there? I don't know about that.
No, I don't know about in the lock, but I know we've had giant catfish stories around where we live man-sized catfish, and to share a little story with you, I had an uncle who was out on this one of these lakes that where some of these catfish had been reported, and he hooked a fish that almost took him to the other side of the lake. He ended up losing it, never could get it reeled in. All he could do was almost hang on for the ride, and he said it drug the boat as if he had like a little trolling motor on it.
Hello? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? Are you there?
Jeremiah?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you not hear me?
I think I've lost you.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see if I come back here in just a second, because we still have you. I'm going to see what's going
on. Oh, there. Okay. Oh, there. I'm hearing you now.
Wow, okay. That was weird, because everything was still coming through. That was kind of weird.
I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with all the storms that have been moving through here. I don't know.
Well, you know, it very well could be, because I know talking to you and someone else and even us today, we've seen these just incredible storms over the last few days. It's been insane.
Hello?
Oh, did I lose you again?
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you keep cutting out a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hope that doesn't continue. But I tell you what, because we're about out of time anyway, Dina. Can you give us again where the book's available and any other books that you have out there? Is this your only book, or do you have any others?
No, this is my only book so far. I'm talking with the publisher about writing another field guide. I'm not sure yet what the subject will be, but this is my first book, and it's available anywhere books are sold, and also on Amazon. And also, you can read my articles, my paranormal articles every week at bellaonline.com/site/paranormal.
All right. Very cool. Well, Dina, let me tell you what. I really appreciate you coming on, and it was a lot of fun. I appreciate you kind of joking around with us a little bit there telling us some about your book and some of your research into it. And I was wanting to get a little bit more into some of your own personal experiences, but maybe we can save that for another show in the future.
I'm so sorry. I can't understand what you're saying.
Oh, I do not know what's going on. Can you hear me any better now?
No, not really. I heard you say, "Can you hear me a little better now?" But I couldn't hear anything before that.
Okay. Well, I tell you, we're going to.
Okay, I'm hearing you.
Okay. Well, Dina, we'll make this before we lose you again. Thank you so much for joining us. And can you hang on the line for us for a second?
Okay, Jeremiah.
All right. Well, everybody, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Gordon Strong about his latest book, Merlin, Master of Magic. Well, welcome back, everybody. That last guest, that was Dina Budd. Do make sure to check out that book, The Wiser's Field Guide to Cryptozoology. Like I said, it's got a little bit of everything in there for you. Now, we're going to move on to a whole other subject, and we're going to be talking about Merlin the Magician, which is with author Gordon Strong, who wrote the book Merlin, Master of Magic. So, Gordon, how are you today?
I'm absolutely fine, and I hope you are too.
I'm doing good, which I guess actually for you, it's how are you this morning, right?
Yes, it is. It's pretty early in the morning, or late at night, depending how you look at it.
Right, right, exactly. Well, I do want to say I appreciate you staying up so late to join us tonight for the next couple hours to talk about Merlin, and I'm sure we're going to get into a little bit more as well, because, you know, not only Merlin, but you also do research in Arthurian legend. And I assume quite a bit of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Arthurian, as you say, Arthurian legends is my main topic. I've done books on Neolithic monuments in England, and I've written a book about the tarot. Mm-hmm. And I'm currently, I've just finished a book on the Grail, which is part of the Arthuriad, as we call it. And various other things, Madame Blavatsky, and also the Golden Dawn, which was a magical organization in the 19th century.
Oh, wow. Now, I have to say, I've actually had the chance to start reading Merlin, Master of Magic, almost finished with it, and this is a lot more... At least to me, this was a lot more than just about Merlin. It was about Merlin, the legends, the tales around him, and not only that, but the magic and what is behind that magic that also surrounds the legends of Merlin.
Well, that's right. I mean, what I was trying to do was, it's quite interesting, really, because when Llewellyn asked me to write the book, and they said, well, you can write a biography of Merlin, which is quite a hard task, really, because, I mean, you can't sort of phone up somebody and say, so, what was Merlin like? You know, what did he watch on TV and that sort of thing?
Right, yeah.
So you're looking at what historical information you have, and also you're trying to fit this all into a tradition of magic and a history of magic and why magic came about. And, just try to get that across to your readers, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I say. There was so much. I mean, to be honest with you, which I'm looking at the total pages, what is it, like almost, about 180, 90-some pages?
Right.
There is a lot of stuff within that number of pages. I mean, I never thought a little book could have so much information, but it's, you know, you, when you start reading this, you know, not only are you learning about Merlin, but then it branches off into so many different ways, because you start tying in, well, you know, he was looked at this way, you know, through this and this way through that. And then you start tying in different myths and legends from different cultures all into it at the same time, saying, well, if you substitute Arthur for this and Merlin for this, you've got the story.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think what's so interesting for me is that it's such a global tale, you know. I mean, particularly, I think, in America. I mean, I was amazed when I first started going to America and giving talks about Arthur and Merlin, of how knowledgeable people were about all the stories. And I think that probably applies nearly anywhere in the world. I mean, I was asked at one point if I would do a tour of Japan.
Wow.
And I said, well, what do they know about King Arthur in Japan? and this guy said, oh, no, they know all about it there. You know, it's a very basic story, you know, a king and a wizard as his helper. And you start off from there and you kind of branch out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, being someone who researches into a lot of this, you know, specifically Merlin, the Arthurian legend, is these accounts, are these people, would you consider them historical or are legends?
Well, I think the difference is interesting, because with King Arthur, you can find a historical personage. You can actually find somebody who was a warrior king in the 6th century in England who defended the country against the invading Anglo-Saxons. And then you can look at the mythical Arthur, who comes a lot later. With Merlin, you've got no historical figure. The only thing you've got to work on is that this is certainly my idea, that it was a title. There were maybe lots of Merlins, but it was a title for a great wizard. So you look at the way he's reported in the context of the Arthurian legends, but you can't really, you know, pin him down in chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the difficulty.
Right. Now, you know, you see, you think there may have been, or even that there was, you know, a lot of Merlins. I think it's kind of an interesting thing. So you think it might have been just, you know, an original Merlin who kind of passed his knowledge down of magic?
Well, I think, you see, I mean, you've got, the other thing is that you've got to try and get into what was in people's heads at this time. And I don't think that, you know, we obviously separate magic and ordinary life, if you like. But whereas I think in those days, it would have all been part and parcel of the same thing, in the sense that people would have done magic in order to make things happen. But that wouldn't have considered to be any big deal.
Right.
They would have just done it.
Right.
They were used to doing it. And obviously, if you had somebody who was successful out there who would do it, he would obviously get a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
I've often thought that there was a lot of failed magicians out there hiding in caves. You know? they couldn't show their faces because they'd screwed it up.
All right. Well, now in the times of I guess when magic was at its height, I mean, could you face any kind of persecution for being a failing magician, for say a prediction not coming true or something you said was going to happen not happening?
Yeah, it's a kind of double-edged sword, isn't it?
Right.
Because, you know, if you're talking about magic in the context, say, of witchcraft, then you have the wise woman in the village and you go to her because, you know, she has knowledge about all sorts of things, childbirth, for instance. But if things go wrong, then you blame her for things going wrong. And so she's, she's really on a tightrope, because she can be held responsible, and if everything goes right, that's great. Mm-hmm. But she has an ambiguous role, and I think that's particularly relevant to magic because if you go back as far as the ancient Egyptians, to be a magician was to have a great status
right.
in society, and you were recognized as being somebody who was part of the temple, part of the whole social structure, part of the religion. But that's the last time that it happens. After that, it starts to become a very individual kind of thing, and it's got this thing of you're an outsider, right. And outsiders are always in a very precarious position. That's the best way I can put it.
Right. Now, I have to ask, because I've seen, I've done this show for about 3 years now.
Sure.
And we've talked a lot about magic in many different forms, Anaki and Enochian, I know it's pronounced a couple different ways, chaos, voodoo, all different kinds of things. And most, 99% of the time, magic is always spelled with a K.
Yeah.
What exactly is the difference? Now, you kind of touch it a little bit, a couple sentences about it in the book, why you use the K, but I was wondering if there was more to it than just that.
Well, there are two things. First of all, I think that you use the K to differentiate it between conjuring, the idea of somebody who produces rabbits out of a hat,
right,
or that kind of thing, like at a kid's party or something like that, which is obviously very different. That's called sleight of hand, really. That's kind of doing things like pulling, eggs out of somebody's ear or something like that. But that is sometimes referred to as magic. But if you're talking about the tradition of spirituality, if you like, and ritual and ceremony, then you're talking about a very different thing. You're talking about a different kind of consciousness, and that's why you use that spelling. Hmm. Aleister Crowley used to use it all the time, and he had a particular theory about the letter K, if you want to go into it in that amount of depth. Hmm. But I think, generally speaking, the K is added for the reasons that I've just explained.
All right. Now, what was Crowley's take on the letter K? Did it have to do something like numerology or something along those lines?
It's the 13th letter of the alphabet.
Mm.
And so he considered it had a particular significance. I mean, I started to go into it, and then I realized that I didn't want to go too far into it.
Right.
Because, who is your audience? Does your audience want to go that deep into things,
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's depending on how deep we're going. It sounds like it may be a whole another show in itself.
Yes, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's the same when we do talks about things like this. That you can go off on all sorts of, byways, if you like, which is all very interesting. But, I mean, you'd be there for hours. And you've got to remember that not everybody goes into these things in huge depth.
Mm-hmm.
The breadth of knowledge is very different.
Right, right. Yeah, we'll probably choose not to go that deep because we haven't even really got into talking about Merlin.
That's what I mean, you see.
yeah. We haven't even really got started here. We're just going over some basic stuff. And
Right.
Now, through your research, where do you feel Merlin kind of started? Because I know you even say, his birth is even shrouded in mystery. So where did Merlin get started at?
I think one has to say, obviously, that, it's a European tradition, and specifically It's the country of Wales. I think that, I mean, I live in the southwest of England, and that is bordering on Wales, and Arthur is very much associated with this part of England. And so the Merlin tradition is, as I say, not very far away, and you've got a lot of Celtic roots surrounding Merlin, and that's very much part of the country of Wales. I mean, obviously there are Celtic roots in Ireland and Scotland, but I think it's centered in Wales, if that helps. I hope it does.
Yeah, now, I mean, with kind of what I read in the book, it sounded like Merlin kind of just, he was really in tune with, you know, the oneness of it all. And some of the ways that you even explain, you know, comparing him to, you know, the tarot cards of the Fool, you know, and the Magician. Is it, you know, do you feel that Merlin's strong association with Druid magic is very accurate, or should it be a much more broad association with magic overall?
Well, I think the Druid tradition is certainly in there. You've got to say that. The problem with trying to associate Merlin with any particular school of magic or group is that you limit it. If you say Merlin's a Druid, then you have to look exclusively at Druids.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to see him as part of a tradition which is much more ancient, and also it's mysterious. I mean, there is this whole thing that he came from Atlantis.
Right.
So you've got a whole other ball game there, because you're talking then about somebody who is, a country where it's some question as to whether it actually existed. So you're looking at him as a force, if you like, the very spirit of magic. I think that's what appeals to me.
Right.
About him, as I said in the book, you know, he's the first and the greatest.
Mm.
And when I was working on the book, I'd written that he was like the Beatles, you know.
Right.
and the first time I was working with her, I said I shouldn't put that in, really, and she said, "Oh no, you must put that in." And you know, it's like the idea of an innovator, you know, somebody who is recognized as being the spirit of a particular genre, I think.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you did go into about Merlin even coming from Atlantis, and I thought that was very interesting, because you talked about, you know, not only Merlin, but I think it was, you know, the queen of Atlantis, and they were kind of like the survivors, in which, wasn't it, you even said that Arthur was the daughter of the queen?
That's right. Well, I mean, it's the whole idea, I think, that Merlin, once he realizes that a king is going to be needed,
mm-hmm.
In the country that he's going to, which is basically Britain, and so he wants to have a king who has a supernatural background, because it's going to be easier for him to be dealing with somebody like that than it is any Joe,
right.
You see what I mean? So he's immediately in touch with him on an unconscious level. And so he sets about making certain that Arthur, the new king, is going to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, his mother is somebody he already knows, if you see what I mean.
Right. Yeah, and what was a little bit more of that? Because you got into because again, you... For a 190-page book, there's a lot of information in here, and
yeah.
So excuse me if I crisscross any of that. But
that's perfectly okay.
But you also got into about the three daughters.
Right. Okay. Yes, you've got. I think you're referring to Morgan le Fay.
Yes.
Yes, and Morgause, and sheesh, I can't remember the name of the other one. Yeah, I mean, they are part of what you see. What's interesting about the R theory thing is it's circular, in the sense that later on in the story, Arthur has a son with Morgan Le Fay, and that son is Mordred, and Mordred will eventually bring about Arthur's death. Okay, so it's almost as if everything is brought from Atlantis at the same time, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. You've got the light and the dark appearing at the same time. It's not as if it's a two-dimensional story and suddenly it's opposite, or the factor that will cause its end suddenly appears later. It comes at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you've got to try and accept that. I mean, which may be hard for people, you know, because I mean, some people may have an image of Arthur as being only this light figure, you know, this sun god. But of course, there are other elements within it. There's got to be, because
right.
there's got to be a balance there.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get into a little bit of where you talked about Merlin having a duality.
Yes.
You know, this good, evil side. And even through some of the legends of Merlin, I mean, it was, even the son of Satan himself.
Yes.
Which was something I'd never even heard. I mean, I've heard the basic stories of Merlin. And
sure.
I would probably be even, you know, embarrassed to say that probably some of that knowledge even come from, like, you know, Saturday morning cartoons. But, but yeah, I mean, I found this very interesting, because you really got into a lot about this duality of Merlin and how, you know, this whole good side and just very soulful and spiritual person, but then also this very darker side that is represented in some of the legends as well.
Sure. I mean, I would say, I think, I mean, Merlin is a gift to Walt Disney.
Yeah.
I mean, you could do anything with him, you know. His father is supposed to be a spirit, and in one legend, and his mother is a nun.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's the idea that his father only exists on the astral plane. Is this a good spirit or a bad spirit? I mean, I'm always a bit careful about using words like good and evil, because you see, one thing particularly to bear in mind is that magic is neutral.
Right.
When people talk about black magic or white magic, I always try and point out, no, the only color that's relevant with magic is gray. Because it's neutral. It's just an energy. I mean, what you do with it is another matter. And that's the will of the individual. But I think what's interesting is that with Merlin, I mean, he is this very powerful figure. And he is obviously, if you judge what he does, in earthly terms, there's bound to be moments where you think, oh, you shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
You know, but then of course you're dealing with something that isn't, it isn't possible to assess on that level. You know, I mean, we're getting into philosophy here almost, because what I'm saying is that if something happens because it's the divine will, it's the will of the universe or the will of God or whatever, then it happens. And, you know, afterwards you can say, well, I think that's bad or good. But then that's our judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I think,
yeah,
Merlin is an instrument of the divine will. And things that happen in his life, you can criticize. But I mean, I don't think he'd be particularly bothered.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, that's something else about the book is you get into, you know, some philosophy as well. I go back to being amazed at how much was really in 190 pages. And, you know, I apologize for going back to that so many times. But it was, you know, I was like, oh my goodness, he's going into so much stuff here.
Well, I mean, I mean, I am interested in a great many things. And, I think what fascinates me at the moment, living at, you know, in the time I do, is that things like cosmology, you know, physics, quantum physics, and philosophy and magic, are all seem to be coming together at one point. And you can, you know, things like parallel universes and things like that, to me, are pure magic. You know. Mm-hmm. And actually the Merlin book is quite mild compared to the stuff I've been writing lately. because, you know, it's getting into some amazing territory, you know, and it's exciting for me, because I'm constantly fascinated by new developments, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, Gordon, I do have a question from the chat room.
Sure.
And let me, okay, Mini Plants in our chat room was asking if Merlin and Rasputin had any similarities.
Well, that one's pretty off the wall. Rasputin, my gosh. Well, it's interesting that Rasputin was an advisor to a monarch, and he had enormous powers. In that sense, I think Rasputin, you would have to say, was a political figure as well as a magical figure, and also I think I don't know. It's kind of he's a shamanic figure. Mm-hmm. Rasputin. I mean, he comes from Siberia, which is the origin of shamanism.
Right.
That's where it comes from. So you have to acknowledge that. I'm always a little bit wary of saying that Merlin was a shaman because it has overtones. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and to try and answer your questioner, I think you've got to be a bit careful about trying to mix two traditions. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, when I'm in America, I mean, I'm very aware of that whole shamanic American Indian tradition. And it is very different to a European one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're still dealing with magic, but it's the approach is different. I don't know. I mean, I hope that helps.
Well, yeah, I hopefully it does. I mean, they're not making a comment in the chat room or anything there, but, you know, I think it definitely does help. Now, in terms of the difference in, you know, looking at kind of magical cultures, I guess, you know, between, say, North America and you know, UK or overseas, what are some of the biggest differences that you have found in your studies?
Well, I think you see that landscape and determines so much. I mean, what I find fascinating about the whole North American culture, I mean, before the white man, if you like, is that it's self-contained. You have this huge country, and yet the culture seems to embrace these vast distances, and also completely it's not been altered at all for thousands of years. Okay, so you've got something that's built up. I mean, it's to do with the ancestors. So much of Native American culture is to do with the ancestors, and it's to do with the with the land and how we live off the land, and we live very simply. And the symbols such as the circle is very important. You know, the teepee is built in that way. And there's, you know, and you make these circles with stones and things like that. So it's a kind of, and also the temperature, you know, the actual temperature, the climate is different, you know, so you, and the animals and the birds are different. So you've got symbols and you've got associations which are particular to that. In Europe, you've got a very different, it's cold, it's the north. So the gods, for instance, if you like, the Nordic gods like Thor and Odin and Freya and people like that, I mean, these are characters that are bundled up in furs.
Right, yeah.
It's to do with survival, you know, and a lot of, you know, and fire is very important, and fighting against things that are terrifying, things that are threatening, and I think that's, you know, that's the whole thing about, in a lot of ways, about Merlin. I mean, he's quite a terrifying figure. You know, he stands there on the mountaintop and he's got his staff and his lightning is cracking around him and all this kind of stuff. He's very elemental. He's not cozy.
You know,
Walt Disney may make him cozy, but he's not really. You know, he's stark. And I think it does reflect that whole European idea that, you know, it's something very black and white, if you like, which I don't see them in the shamanic culture. It's a lot broader, you know, a lot, in some ways a lot more, I don't know, laid back, if you like.
I don't know, I think laid back kind of, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting for me. I mean, I came across the Carlos Castaneda books, I mean, when they first came out in the late 60s, and that was a huge revelation to me, because not only was that a completely different philosophy, but it was also set in a different place, you know, a place that I was completely unfamiliar with, obviously, because I'd never been to, you know, Mexico or somewhere like that. I was only used to my own culture, you know, my own culture, my own land, if you like. Because, I mean, England, a lot of England is, you know, it's very ancient. And, I mean, a lot of it looks exactly the same as it did 2,000 years ago.
Now, if you're just tuning in with us, we are speaking with Gordon Strong, author of Merlin, Master of Magic. He is also a longtime writer, teacher, scholar of English literature, Arthurian legend, magic, and, of course, tarot. Now, Gordon, somebody was bringing up in the chat room here, and before I do that, give us your website as well.
Yes, surely. It's www.gordonstrong.co.uk.
All right. Now, is Merlin Master of Magic available on your website?
It certainly is, and you can obviously, am I allowed to say Amazon?
Yeah, you sure can. Wherever you want to let people know your book is available, yeah, you tell them where that is.
I mean, it is, sure, you can get it from the website, but I'm quite impressed with the way Amazon deals with things. Mm-hmm. It's very simple.
All right.
You also get a very sweet little biography of me and a picture of me on Amazon as well, with all the books I've written, which is quite handy, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Now, there are, someone's bringing up another question in the chat room here, which kind of takes us into a little bit of another subject, that you, even bring up in Merlin, Master of Magic. And this is, again, coming from Many Plants. Do you think that European magic could have started with alchemy from the quest for gold versus the North American Indians not being interested in material goods, so hence the shamanism?
I like that. The pure American versus the greedy, gross European.
That's right. You guys wanted gold. We just wanted to grow some tobacco.
You just wanted a good time. well, I mean, I mean, the other thing, the thing you've got to remember about alchemy is that the essence of alchemy is not actually producing gold per se. It is a philosophy. It's, if I can explain this, it's as almost as if the production of gold, actually having some gold in front of you, is very secondary to the whole idea. Because the gold represents knowledge. It represents the purest knowledge. Because you turn lead, which is the material, the most earthly thing that you can conceive, into the highest spiritual essence, which is gold. I think it's interesting that, that blows my mind, that one.
You know, they may have nutty names in our chat room, but they come up with some good questions.
They certainly do. What is the essence of it? So much of it is power, isn't it? I mean, so much of people associate magic with having power. Now, the power comes from above and is manifest, in the environment you live in the earth that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things about European magic is that you get a whole period around about the 15th century, 16th century, where you have magicians who are celebrities, if you like, and they go from royal court to royal court demonstrating things that they can do. And one of the things they can do is produce gold. And this obviously impresses, mm-hmm. particularly impresses. And so you've got a situation where somebody is earning their living and being quite an important person, an independent person within the culture, you know, and so they're thought of as the magician, Paracelsus, for instance, or somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you've got that, whereas I can't see that being transferred to the Native American, surely, yes, you have these wonderful, not so much, I suppose, what would you call them, kind of witch doctors or something like that, mm-hmm. you have somebody who's attached to the tribe, but I don't think they were celebrities exactly, certainly not as much as the chiefs. They have these wonderful names like Sitting Bull and Geronimo and things like that, But I can you think of a Native American, wizard or shaman?
No, I can't say, let's say maybe, pre-mass media. There's really no, that I'm aware of, any big legend. Of a Native American shaman or type of wizard. That's that might be something kind of interesting to look into to see if there is something out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like I have enough to do. Now I'm going to be wondering about that.
You put that one on the back burner.
That's right. And of course, by the way, you can see where our chat room's mind frame is. They're talking about alchemy in terms of turning things into chocolate.
Oh, well, it's an essential item.
That's right, Forget gold. Let's turn it into chocolate. I thought that was funny.
That's great.
But, yeah, you go into the books about, what we were talking about, of gold being that, secondary goal of alchemy. There was a lot more to it. And, for me personally, I'd never, I'd always heard that was what the alchemists wanted to do. That was it. They wanted to turn, lead into gold and become filthy rich.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you see, one of the other things that has to be said, as I said, when the role of the magician starts to become, it's taken away from the idea that he's part of society, and he starts to become a rather hidden figure, then he starts to become, it gets a bit shady. It gets a bit, you know, he's hiding away. And a lot of medieval magic is to do with evoking things and acquiring things through the use of demons. You evoke your demon and you ask the demon to do something for you. And some of those things are quite basic. I mean, one, you know, wealth, getting a pretty girl,
mm-hmm.
or putting a curse on one of your neighbors. You know, all the sort of things that we do nowadays. But no, I'm kidding. But I mean, there are specific things in mind. Okay, it stops being such a philosophical, ethereal pastime, and it starts to have these kind of overtones of. You know, you go to the wizard and you find him and he lives in this funny little hovel somewhere in a back street and you ask him for a talisman or you ask him for, you know, a tonic or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of gets a bit, it doesn't really emerge out of that for quite some time, really, probably until the 19th century. I mean, in Europe, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, Gordon, it is about time, which I know I told you about it. We have our talk and thought segments at about 10:45.
Okay.
So we're right there at it, which you know what? It looks like what everybody has voted on fits on really kind of nicely with tonight's show.
Okay.
And that is the power of the mind.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, this, you know, so for the next 15 minutes or so, we'll talk about the power of the mind. And of course, we can, you know, being tonight's subject is magic, I think they kind of go hand in hand, so we can kind of, in essence, continue talking about magic. But, you know, for me, I've always been fascinated with the power of the mind, because I think it is something that is, we are very, very far from tapping into its full potential. And, you know, in terms of magic, what do you feel, you know, a magician can achieve?
Well, I mean, I think a magician can achieve anything, anything that, you know, basically I think the power of the mind is that whatever you can imagine, you can manifest.
Oh, wow.
Obviously that's going to have limits on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as you say something like that, then everybody wants $1 million.
Right.
It's, you know, it's going back to that whole thing of if what you want to manifest is in line with the divine will, if it is supposed to happen, then it will. But I think we're dealing with two things here, really, because, I mean, the power of the mind, I mean, the mind, one thing I ought to explain, and I think this is significant, is that the brain and the mind are two different things.
Right.
Okay, so the brain is an organ, you know, same as your liver or your heart, okay? And it functions, unless it's damaged, it functions perfectly. The mind is a word that we use to describe what the brain does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's where we're dealing with things like consciousness. We're dealing with how do you see what's going on. And one thing I think you have to say about a magician is that they're aware of what's going on, and they're also aware of the potential of what's going on. I mean, so everybody has, in theory, the potential of being a magician, but they aren't. And the reason they're not is sometimes very simple. They don't want to be.
Right.
they'd rather work on the railroad or whatever it is. You know, they don't want to be involved with this. I mean, you know, being a magician is a job like anything else. You know, you train to do it and you work within it. It's fascinating, it's mysterious, and it obviously it has it at its center the power of the mind, because it's to do with consciousness. And one of the definitions of magic is the ability to change consciousness.
Hmm.
I would advise any of your listeners to read Dion Fortune, who wrote extensively about magic, and it was her who came up with that definition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of all the people I think that writes about magic, her and somebody called Bill Gray are incredibly useful, because they define in quite simple terms something that a lot of people find quite hard to get their head around, you know, to understand what it's all about. I mean, I didn't. I mean, when I was, you know, when I first got involved in things like this, when I was about, I don't know, 19 or 20 or something, I thought magic was something to do with black cats and
right.
You know, stuff like this, until I researched it, you know. I mean, I was very lucky. I mean, we had a huge library in the city where I was in, Bristol, and there was, you know, loads of old books about things like this, and so I could find out. And I also met magicians, you know, really early on, and got into the idea that you studied and you applied yourself 100% to this. It wasn't something you did on the weekends.
Right, yeah, right, yeah.
And I think that's something that I would, you know, I would underline, is that it's not something to mess with. You know, it's something that you should be very clear about, you know, if you're going to be involved in magic, as to why you're doing it. Motive is all, you know.
Yeah.
You know, stop me if, you know, you don't want me to go down this road, but I am quite responsible about that. You know?
Well, yeah, and I mean, anything you do, I mean, there's always a potential for danger. I mean, especially stuff, you know, like this. You are, you know, again, you're looking at, you know, exactly as I said, you know, changing consciousness, altering realities.
Exactly.
You know, that is something, I mean, it's a very, especially in our time. Now, maybe, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago, this was a more common thing. But in our time, I think we've really diluted that power of the mind. And we don't understand it when we go, you know, when we have people getting into new things such as, you know, magic, ritual magic. Yes, that you've got to be careful.
I do. I mean, and I think, you know, one of the most powerful forces we have in the world now is the media,
mm-hmm.
It's TV, you know, things like that. And I mean, that has an enormous influence on consciousness. You know,
wow.
I mean, people think that TV is real. Let me tell you, my friend, it's pictures in a box. You know, and when you find people repeating what they've been told,
mm-hmm.
then that's dangerous, because they're not thinking for themselves. And I think one of the lessons of magic is that it's about the individual. It's about the individual's consciousness. How do I see the world? And how, you know, can I bring in all these things that are stimulating me, and can I use that power, you know, for a particular end,
mm-hmm.
you know, rather than being used by something else, which is why I find, in some ways, you know, TV quite terrifying.
Yeah, and you know, and I guess that would kind of bring up, you know, along the lines of power of the mind, that excuse me, you know, things like media, maybe taps into the lack of power of the mind.
Yes,
you know,
I do.
Yeah,
well, it gives you an imagination, doesn't it?
Right, it does, and you know, so it is kind of sad sometimes to walk around and see how much people's thoughts and opinions are based on just what they hear on the TV, because, you know, Fox News or CNN said it was so.
Exactly, exactly. And I mean, you know, America is always one step ahead of the rest of the world. And, the American media is very clever. You know, it's very good at projecting one particular opinion. And you've just got to be careful, I think. That you say, oh, well, okay, yes, yeah, I can see where you're coming from, but rather than saying, oh, yeah, you're right,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, I think what is so important to me is the fact that your imagination is creative, you know, it's not, a lot of people seem to think that the imagination is just fantasy. It isn't. Fantasy is in a lot of ways worthless, you know, because it's just, oh, I wish I could have this or that or the other.
Right.
But your imagination is doing something else, because you're working on something. You're trying to see what is involved with something. I mean, that's why symbols are very intrinsic to magic. You take a sword, okay, and we've been talking about Arthurian things, Excalibur. What does that represent? You know,
mm-hmm.
it's endless. The Grail, what does that represent? You know, I mean, that's, you know, infinite. Mm-hmm. And those things, you know, if you're meditating on those or you're concentrating on those things, they are huge,
yeah.
you know. A lot more fascinating than Fox News.
You know, I have to agree with you. And, you know, that is something, I was talking with someone the other day, and we were kind of talking about creativity and imagination.
Mm.
And, you know, I tend to be a very creative person. And I said, you know, in everything I do, I said, I see an opportunity to be creative.
Yeah.
You know, in everything, even mundane stuff, washing the car, for some reason, I'll try to figure out some different way to wash the car for some reason. You know, just to make it a little more creative. And I do this with everything.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, you've got to do it, so you might as well do it with all your body
right.
and soul.
Right. How do you use the power of that mind to see what I can do with it? You know, maybe one day I'll just walk out there and the car will wash itself.
You know? You hope.
Now, would that be a little a little bit of you know, the difference in maybe, you know, everyday life, imagination, creativity, and that with magic is, you know, like you were talking about with like fantasy, where it's an I wish, where with magic, it's no longer I wish, it's this is what is going to happen. This is what I'm going to do.
Well, I think so. I mean, I one of the questions I often get asked at talks, and this is going back to the $1 million thing, and they're saying, well, people say to me, well, can I wish for the lottery numbers, you know, the winning combination. And I say, yes, you can do a magical ritual to find that out. If it's, you know, intended that that's what's going to happen. If it isn't, you can do that ritual from now until, you know, the time you die, and you won't find those numbers. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's, You can't just suddenly decide that you want something and it will appear for you unless it's supposed to. I mean, it comes back to so much of why am I doing this? And what one of the things that used to happen when people joined a magical school, there was a question. And the question was, why do you seek? And the answer was, I seek in order to serve. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if you got that wrong, then they didn't take you on.
Huh.
Because they realized that your motives weren't correct. They weren't
right.
pure. Okay? So, you know, why do you want this power? You want this power to bring light into the world, to help people.
Hmm.
Okay? Now, that's fine. That's exactly what we want. If you want that power to do something else with that involves some egotistical reasons, then we don't want to know. And that's a big, you know, it's a simple lesson, but it's a very big one.
Yeah, it really is. Now, and this kind of ties along with it as we kind of exit out of talking thoughts here and kind of getting ready to take a little bit of a break. Let me get this question in from the chat room. And they're saying, if you do magic or law of attraction or intention, is there a payback or a rule of three or, you know, which I've heard that,
yeah.
you know, you get
yeah,
it back
sure.
tenfold.
Well, yes. I mean, I think the simple thing is don't curse people.
Yeah, just don't do it. You don't have to worry about it, right?
You know, I mean, that is that tradition. I mean, you know, witches say that. Yeah, you can curse somebody, but it comes back on you three times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, well, I guess that's what's supposed to happen, isn't it? You know, it's the idea that... if you put it out, it will come back. And I don't know. I mean, you can simplify it and say, well, if you're kind to people, people will be kind to you back. It doesn't always work like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's more likelihood that it will. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. And you know, I have to agree with you because... You know, I try in everything I do, I try to be kind to people.
Yeah.
And you honestly do see, yeah, you know, there are going to be people who take advantage of it. There are going to
sure.
be people who, you know, stab you in the back, whatever.
Yeah.
But you're going to see a lot more people return that kindness in many different ways. But I think, you know, I think some of it might be, you know, we look for it to come back in a certain way and we don't get it that way. And so then we think, oh, well, you know, what's the use? But you didn't realize you actually got that kindness back to you, but it may have not been a, you know, it may have not been a $500, you know, dollar check.
Well, it's very simple things, isn't it? I always make a point of saying to a checkout girl in a supermarket, how are you today?
Mm-hmm.
And I did that once and she looked at me and she said, nobody's ever said that to me before.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's it, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
I treated her like she's a human being. You know, she's just the same as me. And I've actually inquired about how she's feeling and how she's doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that, even little simple things like that. I mean, even if you walk down the road and you smile, the chances are people will smile back.
They will. And or a wave or a hello or just like you said. I mean, even
yeah.
saying, you know, how are you today can bring a smile to somebody's face. And,
absolutely.
And it is so amazing. And you know, we are surrounded. But again, here we go back to the media. We are surrounded by nothing but doom and gloom.
Mm.
You know, it's war here, war there. The oil spill's taken over the coast. You know, a family of five was murdered yesterday right outside of town.
Yeah.
And we do kind of walk around in this fear. And when someone kind of comes up and says, hey, how are you doing? It kind of breaks that for a moment.
Yeah.
It says, oh, wow.
I agree.
There are good people in the world.
Yeah, well, it's like news, isn't it? News is always bad news.
Yeah, it's always bad news. I mean, you know.
Why don't they just say, hey, the sun's just come up. Isn't that great?
Yeah, you know, I've always wondered, you know, what would the world be like if that's how the news started up? Hey, the sun's up. It's a new day. We're all alive. Wonderful.
Right.
You know, instead of, oh, well, you know, 12 people were shot dead today, you know, trying to get on the bus to go to work. You know, and that's what we hear. It's really sad sometimes. Really, really. Well, Gordon, before we go to the break here, and please give out your website one more time, which is also where Merlin Master of Magic is available. And we're going to come back, and I tell you, I've got something I want to talk to you about. Someone brought it up in the chat room, and I want to get your take on it. So give your website for us, please.
Okay. It's www.gordonstrong.co.uk.
All right, thank you. And again, that is Merlin, Master of Magic. But don't go anywhere, because Gordon's still with us for a whole another hour, and we've got plenty more to talk about. So we'll be back in just a moment with Gordon Strong. Well, you are tuned in to Shadows in the Dark right here on Tenacity Radio at tenacityradio.com. And tonight we are speaking with Gordon Strong, the author of Merlin, Master of Magic, which I think we've kind of been a little bit on all kinds of subjects tonight, which is always a lot of fun. But I tell you, before we went to the break there, Gordon, I told you I was going to share a little story with you and kind of get your take on it.
Yep.
This happened to me when I was about 10 years old, and someone had brought it in the chat room, which is why it kind of made me think about it. Except for the fact that I'll never forget it. But me and my older brother, we're about 2.5 years apart, where we went on a family vacation. It was the whole family, all brothers, sisters, all that good stuff. And we went out west to Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, seen Mount Rushmore, the buffaloes, which was an amazing thing for me to see the buffaloes. I was really fascinated with buffaloes at 10 years old. We pulled into the parking lot of Yellowstone National Park, which we were going to check in. We were in an RV, so basically we were crossing the country in an RV.
Yep.
And while we were sitting there in the parking lot, we had stomped off at some little, side store that had the little novelty souvenir items, and we each bought a pair of rain dance bells, Native American bells for rain dances.
Yeah.
Well, we were sitting there waiting for our parents to, check in to the campground, which, at this time you could actually leave your kids out in the car. You wouldn't come back out with a swarm of cops to arrest you.
Yeah.
So we looked at each other and we were like, hey, let's see if we can make it rain. So we put our little rain bells on. We shucked the bells and we did our best imitation of a Native American chant that we could.
Right.
And it started raining.
It had to, didn't it?
Yes, it started raining. And, of course, we look at each other. It kind of was in awe and terrified at the same time.
Yeah.
You have that whole, wow, that was really cool, but did we really just do that? That's kind of scary. So, we looked at each other, and we're like, wow, that is neat. Now let's see if we can make it stop raining. So, we weren't going to just stop there.
Right.
We had just done something amazing. We were going to push it as far as we could. So we shook our bells, we chanted, and it stopped.
Oh.
Well, yes. After that, we took the bells off and we put them down. Because for a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old, that was just a little bit much.
Yeah.
Now, someone who studies magic.
Right.
Would you see that as an act of magic? Would you see us making it rain? Even if, I don't know, maybe there was a purpose behind it or even just our own fascination, but, the will of the divine.
Yeah, well, I think what that is what's called sympathetic magic, in the sense that you're doing something for a specific purpose using, something that's traditionally used for that purpose. There are various other things you can use, which I've seen from Africa and things that make a kind of scraping noise that sounds like rain coming down,
Mm-hmm.
But it works. And I think what's interesting is that the fact that you were 10 years old, because then you don't doubt things,
Yeah.
There aren't other things coming in saying, oh, don't be so silly, and it's not going to work and all that stuff. You are 100% in there. And I see no reason to doubt the fact that, you caused that to happen.
And me and my brother, we've talked about it so many times. Yeah, because, again, that's something that just doesn't leave you. And
I bet.
And that's one of, we were like, how did we do it? And, for me, it was always, just like you say, well, there was no doubt. We were kind of, at that age of innocence where,
sure.
We thought anything was really, truly possible. We didn't have things to knock down, those kind of thoughts. And when we done it, again, there was no doubt, and we knew we were going to make it rain somewhere deep down inside, and it did. And, for me, I even take a little bit farther to say, when we get into talking about the divine will, saying, well, that to me, it was like a peek into what is possible. You know, almost saying, hey, Jeremiah, that's possible. Don't give up on searching for things like that because, it just happened.
Well, it's faith.
Right.
You know, it's an example of that, you know, things can happen as you want them to happen. And I think, I think what's interesting there is that you link into something that is different from like an everyday consciousness, you know, because you're in another world there. And that's the world that magic is in. It's there right next to the ordinary world, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And what the magician does is learn to slip into it and slip backwards, of course.
Hmm.
I mean, slip back to the ordinary reality. I mean, if you if you go into that other world and you stay there, you might be in trouble. But, I mean, you know, that is, it's, you know, in traditional terms, it's called passing through the veil. You know, it's, you go into this, I mean, if you're familiar with the tarot, the High Priestess card, I mean, she sits in front of the veil, and if she thinks you're worthy, she allows you to go beyond into that world. Mm-hmm. And that's what you did.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now you brought up the tarot cards, and you had a nice little section in Merlin Master of Magic where you talked about, you know, Merlin's association with the magician card and the
right.
the Joker, you know, trickster,
the
jester,
yeah.
the fool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what was really neat about it is it wasn't like, you know, okay, well, this is kind of how the association is, but you went into a very nice, you know, description of what all of that stood for, you know, having a foot in heaven, you know, a foot on earth and going from the known to the kind of chaotic, the unknown. Kind of comparisons of it all. And can you kind of explain a little bit of that for us? Because again, I thought it was very fascinating because I had never looked at those cards in such a manner.
Yeah, well, the Fool card is an amazing card. I mean, and it's also one that's misunderstood a mm-hmm. lot of the time. I mean, you have the image of this guy stepping off a cliff, and I suppose if you showed that image to, you know, a lot of people, they'd say, well, he is a fool.
Right.
because he's going from security, he's going from what's safe into the unknown and possibly his destruction. But I mean, within that, of course, is the idea that what he's actually leaving isn't real anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you can't hold on to anything. You know, because none of it is real. So what he has is the ability to say, well, it doesn't matter where I am, whether I'm on the cliff or I'm in the middle of the air, you know.
Yeah.
It any state is okay, because he's aware of it, and that's the difference. I mean, the Fool is a fascinating concept. Shakespeare was very good with this. He uses fools in his plays because they can say anything. They can do anything because they're fools.
Right.
But they're wiser than the people that they're talking to often.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, there's a great line in Star Wars which the guy says, Who's the bigger fool, the fool or the fool who follows him? that always impressed me. You know, it's a wonderful card, and also I think there's a huge link between the Fool card and the Magician, because the Fool represents the energy that the Magician is using. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of the Magician card, it's quite a static card in a lot of ways. You know, he's standing there taking the power from above and transmitting it down below. But you look at the Fool card, he's in motion. It's kinetic, you know.
Right.
And that's the actual energy that the Magician is using. You know, he's using the moment. He's absolutely convinced that moment he can do something.
Right.
Right, because he doesn't He doesn't see the moment as transitory. He doesn't just see it as a second. He sees it as eternity. He stopped the world, you know. If you're familiar with the Castaneda books, that's what Don Juan's always talking about. He's saying, stop the world, you know.
Right.
Stop the world, examine it, you know, look at it. You know, you can halt time.
Yeah. Now, so for a magician, I guess, you know, time, in essence, really doesn't exist.
No. I don't think it does for anybody.
Yeah. I agree, but there definitely are some people who believe that it, you know, it does exist, but, you know, for
me... it's convenient. It's a convenient thing. I mean, you know, you have a watch and, you know, the little numbers move along,
right.
You know, because, you know, you have to be somewhere in 10 minutes or
right.
an hour or, you know, or something like that. But, I mean, it is an illusion, you know, and I mean... If you impose these things upon yourself so that they start to rule you, then that's where the trouble is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, having said that, I'm somebody who, you know, if I say I'm going to be there at 4 o'clock, I'm there at 4 o'clock.
Right.
You know, I'm a punctual guy, but. But I still realize that these things are, you know, we have assumed them. They don't really exist, you know. I mean, past, present, future. They don't exist, really. You know, it's all one.
Mm-hmm. Now, for a practicing magician or one
yeah.
who is kind of, you know, I guess getting interested in starting... Is there a lot of work that has to go behind, I guess, kind of getting rid of the illusions?
Well, you have a big question here. I mean, you're talking about how should you train yourself to be a magician? Is that what you're...
Well, I guess in a way, or kind of, you know, what kind of work has to go into getting, like I say, getting rid of the illusions that, you know, we've attached ourselves to, you know, over the years?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think awareness is the thing that I would stress. You know, not accepting that something, as we just talked about that time, not accepting that something is the be all and end all, mm-hmm. and also finding things out for yourself. You know, trusting in your vision. You know, if somebody says to me, "I've seen fairies." Then I don't say to them, "No, you haven't."
Right.
I immediately say, "Tell me about it."
Right? Yeah.
You know, and that's a very big thing. You know, I mean, I have people come to me for consultations, and they say, "You're the only person who will understand," which is very flattering, but it may also be true.
Right.
You know. And I think that particularly when you're into the kind of stuff that, you know, we're into and your listeners are into, one of the hardest things is that you feel isolated. You know, your friends may not understand what you're up to, you know, or, you know, you can't find anybody who's you're in harmony with. And I think that that's really important is when you're starting out is to be able to discuss things with people.
Mm-hmm.
And say, "Hey, this happened, you know, and this kind of thing happened." I mean, it's like your story of, you know, when you were 10 years old. I mean, you had your brother, so, you know, you could kind of talk about it,
right.
You know? I mean, imagine if you were on your own.
Yeah, you know, we definitely, in telling those stories to people, they give us those crazy looks like, "Yeah, whatever. You know, hey, we're in a drought, make it rain right now." And you kind of like, "Well,
exactly.
I don't know if it can work like that, to be honest."
No.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And I mean, and I think, you know, things are very precious to people. That's what I think.
I think
that the imagination and the vision and the dreams and beliefs that an individual has are really, really valuable and precious, and they should hold on to those things. Sometimes it's not a good idea to tell people about things.
Mm.
You know, there's this great thing about sharing. Okay, that's great. but be careful who you share it with.
Right. Now, see, for me, sharing things, you know, if someone says, hey, I saw a fairy, for me, I'd be like, well, you know, I host this show called Shadows in the Dark, and we have an hour slot just perfect for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's yeah. The professional in you.
But, you know, doing this show has really, for myself, I mean, I've always been an open person, but I have to say it's made me be, you know, even more open to other people's stories and sharing my own strange experiences, because I've had quite a many. You know, through the years and being able to not only, you know, I know when I do the show, it's literally thousands of people are going to hear it, but even face to face, you know, where I last worked, everybody, you know, knew me as the guy who was into the weird and strange, but they found it also as a fascination. You know, I couldn't sit down and eat lunch because, you know, people would sit down at the table, well, hey, you heard any good ghost stories lately? Or, you know, you've been hanging out in any haunted places.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. But I mean, it's what you link in with, isn't it? I mean, I think there's the other side of it, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I worked for a year in Glastonbury in England, and that is the kind of, I don't know, New Age center of England, if you like, and it's full on. It hits you all the time, and you feel like saying, for God's sake, talk about making a cake. Anything but your spiritual path. You
know?
No. You know, you've got to turn off, turn it off sometimes.
Yeah, and I find that very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. Now, kind of back a little bit to Merlin. What about any kind of association or ties with Merlin to things like, you know, Stonehenge? Obviously, one of the most famous monuments or ancient structures in Europe. What about some other ones as well as Stonehenge?
Yeah, I mean, I think. Now, this, I think, is a point where you do have to try and bring in some chronology here. Merlin is, there's a lot of association between Druids and Stonehenge. And in fact, that really is mythical in its purest sense. The thing about stone circles and places like that is nobody really knew what happened there, or in fact even why they were built. Okay, a lot of people come up with a lot of things, and there's lots of populist theories about, particularly about Stonehenge. Now, Merlin comes from an earlier tradition, but that is not to say that you don't have the idea of circular things or circular monuments that Merlin was involved with. I mean, for instance, he provides the round table, or he suggests that the round table is brought to Camelot, and it comes as the dowry with Guinevere when she marries Arthur. And the round table is obviously incredibly significant. It's the fact that there is no head of the table, if you like, is particular. Mm-hmm. Also, a circle is, infinite. And it represents the spirit. It represents, the sun is circular, etc. So what I'm trying to say is that you've got to look a bit further than the idea of Stonehenge being circular or a stone circle being circular and think that Merlin was there. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's as if he's sowing the seeds for things like that. I mean, my own view about stone circles, I'm extremely fortunate I have one. I was going to say I don't own one, but there's one you know, about 30 minutes drive from where I live, a place called Stanton Drew. And I'm certain that those things were a reflection of the heavens. They were constructed to illustrate the relationship between the sun and the moon and the earth. They're really big concepts. You know, sure, they may have done ritual magic there, they may have done ceremonies there, but it's a much bigger thing, you know.
All right.
It's a much bigger thing. And it's very tempting sometimes to put all these things together in a little picture. But I think that that's, you know, it in some ways that doesn't bring the total value of the thing in.
Now, I watched this thing about Stonehenge, and if we go back from the media, I watched that. But it was really interesting because they got talking about the structure of Stonehenge, and what they were tying into it was the acoustics and the effects of a repetitive rhythm on the human mind. And how that might have played roles into possible rituals that were done at Stonehenge. Have you ever heard of any of that?
I have, yes. I mean, remember, I'm not an expert on Stonehenge.
Right.
But, I mean, one of the things about Stonehenge is that it's very, very different to the traditions of other stone circles in Britain. It's, you can almost pin so many things on it. Whereas what I've just been talking about with the planetary thing, it applies a lot more to other stone circles. But going back to your question about the acoustics, yes, definitely. I mean, there is a theory that the stones were moved with sound. Those huge blocks of stone came from a part of Wales, which is a long, long way away. I mean, okay, they could have been transported on rafts across the sea, along the river, across land, using log rolls, you know, and erected there. Okay, that's the, you know, the practical thing. But whenever they've tried to do that, you know, even using modern technology, it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
It's the same with the pyramids. You know, how did they get them so exact? You know, within a tolerance of, you know, a quarter of an inch.
Right.
These things, you know, are produced. And it's, you start to think, well, hang on a second. They must have had other means than just manpower, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I've seen incredible illustrations of Tibetan monks raising boulders and things just with horns and drums, the sound of
these things. Yeah, see, I've heard a lot of those kind of thrown into the theories of how the pyramids were built, that you know, they moved these stones with sound.
Yeah, and I mean, sound is incredibly powerful. I mean, I do, with my wife in America, I do a lot of, and other people, I do toning. And, you know, you can go to a place, you know, you go to, you know, a big waterfall or inside a long barrow or something like that, and you can pick up the actual note that represents that place. And if you can tune into that and harmonize with it, incredible things happen, you know. And a lot of people don't realize that sound must have been used ritually, you know, thousands of years ago, because we're surrounded by sound,
right.
you know, piped music or TV or whatever. And, you know, if silence was your normal experience and then you heard sound, it must have been incredibly dramatic.
Yeah.
You know, And to use that in a specific way and have it organized and ordered for a particular purpose, you know, I'm pretty sure that must have been a very powerful force and would have achieved things. and there's no reason at all why, you know, things could have been not things could have been done at Stonehenge in the way that you're describing, you know, mm-hmm. acoustic waves and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I tell you, for me, even though that it was very fascinating, I think that the most fascinating part of what they were talking about was, you know, the effects of that repetitive rhythm on consciousness, on the mind, and kind of what kind of the trance it would put you in.
Yeah, well, I mean, just saying, you know, chanting Om.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
you do that for 30 minutes, and you'll go places.
That's right. So something's going to happen. now, Gordon, I have to ask you, because I was honestly amazed at the reference to UFO sites in the book. It was actually, I don't know, quite a few times when you were talking about places or things, you would reference in there that are you know, mentioned in there. Well, there's also a lot of alien, you know, reports of UFOs and alien visitation.
Right.
Well, was there a reason why you wanted to point that out about these? And you know, is there some kind of tie that you feel is in there with magic?
Well, I think I'm a little bit lost to think of the specific references that I made.
Well, it was basically just that you know, if you mentioned a location, you would just say something along the lines, well, there's also reports of UFOs.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that the point is that if you have a powerful place, that is more likely to attract UFO activity. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of places that may very well have been significant have been covered up or built on or something like that, yet they still maintain that energy. So there's no reason why, you know, UFOs shouldn't appear, I don't know, in Albertson's parking lot, you know.
Right.
I had to get Albert's. but you know, in the same way as they might appear on the top of Glastonbury Tor or at Stonehenge or something like that. You know, I think there's a huge link. There's a huge link between what we call alien activity and sacred sites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I talked about this place, Stanton Drew, near where I live, and I have spent nights there. You know, I get in a sleeping bag in the summer, and I saw more shooting stars than I'd ever seen in my entire life. You know,
wow.
Yeah, and I mean, it's as if you start to clue in to the heavens. Because there's nothing to stop you. I mean, very fortunately, there's no light pollution in that part, you know. And so, I mean, you know, particularly, I mean, in America, where you've got huge, you know, areas which are free from light pollution, and you know, the skies are there open for you to contemplate. Because if you're connecting in your mind with something out there, then there's a good chance it'll connect with you.
Right.
You know, and I think that that's a lot of it. It's not just trying to take a photograph of it or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's much more to do with are we getting a link here? You know, am I communicating with something out there?
You know, and I think that's a great point in terms of photographs, because you see, I mean, we're always videotaping, we're always photographing everything, and do we lose a connection with that moment? Because, you know, I guess in the back of our mind, it's like, well, I've got a photograph of it, why do I need to?
Yeah,
you know,
well,
I've got that
right.
Memory now.
I mean, there's a heck of a lot of stuff on YouTube. I mean, what's interesting is actually divided into this is genuine UFOs and these are fake
right.
ones. Why does anybody want to watch the fake ones? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, it's so much that the visual aspect of it isn't as important as the, you know, as the intuitive aspect of it.
Right.
You know, it's got to be, because so much of, you know, so much of magical activity, you can't see it. I mean, if you watch somebody doing a ritual, you may not actually see anything. It may in fact look incredibly boring, you know.
Right.
But there's all sorts of stuff happening that if you tune into it, sure, you know, there's a whole scene going on. But in its basic sense, it's pretty sort of mundane.
Yeah, you know, if you tune into it, it might just rain. You know.
As you proved.
That's right. And if you're 10 years old, it will scare you.
Well, that's right. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, I've never tried it. Me and him, either one. Matter of fact, we were visiting each other just a couple months back, and it even asked, hey, have you ever tried that again? And I was like, no, I haven't. There was just something about it that said, okay, well, that, you know, hey, I know it's possible now, but I have no reason to really do it right now.
No, well, I think that's a good lesson in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, trying to, I don't know, I mean, you could have gone on TV, you could have made an industry out of it.
Right, which one was it? I mean, was it the 20s, 30s, all the rainmakers were, I can't remember what era it was, but they had all these, you know, companies that claimed they could make it rain.
Oh, I know. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I must just mention something which is interesting. I mean, you obviously know about vortices in North America and these various places. I went to a place called Confusion Hill, which is in Northern California, and this is an extraordinary place where physical phenomena occur. You know, it's a little bit difficult to summarize it, but it's as if the laws of physics are turned upside down.
Right. Yeah, we have a Mystery Hill.
Right. Right.
Uh huh. It's the exact same thing. You go into one of the attractions is bounce a ball on the floor and it bounces.
That's it.
Yeah, either back at you or it'll bounce in in a direction. Even if you drop it straight down, it'll shoot way off from you.
That's right. Yes. I mean, it's those kind of things. Well, what I find interesting is that those places, you know, they were very popular, I think, in America in about the 20s. And they built all these strange houses and structures to accentuate this whole idea. And it's like a fairground. I mean, they're quite interesting even for that aspect of it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think that it's fascinating the way that things are popularized, whereas the truth of the thing still stays intact. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I tell you, there's I've never, you know, with Mystery Hill, I've never been to it, even though it's only just a few hours away. I ought to go sometime.
Right. You should do some dowsing there. Do take a pendulum and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was incredible at Confusion Hill because I just, you know, wear sort of hippie trinkets around my neck, so I can you know do a pendulum and the pendulum would spin one way and you'd move it like 2 inches to the right and it would spin the other way.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, something's happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's, before we run out of time here, we've been back and forth, a little bit of Merlin, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
A lot of this and a lot of that.
I know, but I tell you, it's always makes some of the funnest shows. But, you know, you get into talking to, you know, about certain things, you can just branch off in so many directions with it. Because it is, you know, it's which is kind of, you know, also the essence of magic. It's all connected.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's endless.
Yeah. Now, what about the legacy of Merlin. Where do you think it's headed? I mean, do you, you know, it's kind of, to me, and this is, you know, my own personal opinion, it's kind of on a fence of, you know, being simply a legend to being a real thing.
Mm. Well, I think it's quite interesting, isn't it, the way that it's an archetype. You know, if you read Lord of the Rings, I mean, Gandalf is obviously based on Merlin.
Mm-hmm.
And Gandalf is a big archetype in the, you know, 20th century, in the 21st century.
Yeah.
And I think these things stay. I mean, what I find interesting is that they stay in the unconscious. And Arthur, Merlin, the knights, the Grail, the quest, they're all there, you know, and they'll never go away because they're very, very deep in the collective unconscious, as Jung would call it. And it's also manifest. I mean, you know, I loved the Lord of the Rings films. I thought they were fabulous, you know. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that kind of depiction of things. And, you know, it's the same way as you can't say, oh, we must get rid of technology, you know, and go back to the simple way. Well, we can't do that. You know,
right.
we've gone too far. And there's no reason why you shouldn't use the technology to increase the magic, if you see what I mean.
Hmm.
I mean, I think Merlin would have got a PC straight away, I can tell you. he would have found out ways of using it.
All right.
I mean, because he had the tools that he had, which was his staff and his mind and his knowledge and his wisdom. But, you know, you can apply that at any time. You know, you use the things that are around you in the moment that you're incarnated. You know, and I think that that's what's so interesting. I mean, I find the whole New Age movement, and I, you know, I've been around long enough that I'm old age. I find it fascinating the way that it's continually being transformed. You know, and it brings in all sorts of elements. You know. And that's fascinating. You know, I mean, obviously I am, you know, when I'm researching and when I'm writing, I'm referring to older texts and older authorities, but I'm still reading the new stuff that comes out, and I think that's what people should do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Combine the two.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Gordon, I've got another question from the chat room here.
Yeah, sure.
And, of course, we've got another strange name. This is Captain Bugface.
good old Captain.
Yeah, good old Captain Bugface. He's sailed everywhere. his question is, says he's curious about real magicians, those who believe they are working with spirits and nature, and those who use sleight of hand. Did ancient magicians consider this cheating or just part of their art, using the sleight of hand?
Good question. Well, I was talking about the difference between a conjurer and a magician.
Mm-hmm.
And the differentiation being that a conjurer is someone who... gosh, what was the name of that guy? I can't remember that guy. There's been quite a few of them. You see them on TV, and I can't think of anybody's name now, who do illusions. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, originally, conjuring meant evoking spirits. Okay? Mm-hmm. So there is a link between the ancient tradition of magic and... the modern concept of it. It's just that that's been made into a huge industry, if you like. David Copperfield, that was the guy I was trying to think
right.
of. He'd make airplanes disappear and stuff like that. And you know, that's a whole different thing. But it's, I think that the magicians of ancient times were not above using illusions. But I don't think that that was their, I don't think that that was their real identity, if you like. They, if they did a trick, they knew they were doing a trick. Okay?
Right.
I mean, I think that's the difference. I mean, you certainly can't say, oh, well, they didn't, you know, pull off some stunt. I don't see why they shouldn't, because it's the awareness of what you're doing. If you're pulling off a stunt and saying, hey, listen, I'm a great magician, that's one thing.
Right.
You know, I mean, that deception is one thing, you know. That's you know, that's dodgy territory, I think. Does that answer the captain?
I believe so. I have another question from the chat room. That this is actual name, Rick, in the chat room.
Oh wow!
Yeah, we go from Mini Plants, Captain Bugface to Rick. and Rick is wanting to know if you are well aware of Welsh author Alan Wilson, and if you are, or I guess even maybe you've heard something along those lines, what do you think about King Arthur II being born around 533 AD?
Well, for a start, I'm not familiar with Alan Wilson, I'm afraid. I will check it out. I'm going to write it down now. 530 AD is around the time that the historical, slightly later in fact, I would say, appears in history. Okay? Now, the Welsh connection is interesting because in Britain, various areas claim Arthur.
All right.
Cornwall does. They do here in Somerset. The Welsh do. And the Scots do. And also in Brittany, you know, near France. So there are whole traditions that say, no, this is the real Arthur. You know, I mean, that's the best I can do there. I didn't know about King Arthur the Second. That's a new one on me.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't say I've heard it myself, and maybe I guess which brings up can someone contact you on your website if they have other questions or maybe want to share information that they may know? I mean, you know, King Arthur the Second, Alan Wilson, you know, Rick might be able to shoot some information.
Well, that's fine. My email is on there.
Okay, and give us your website again, because we are getting close to getting ready to close out. So the website, and again, Merlin Master of Magic, available there as well.
Yeah, it's www.gordonstrong.co.uk.
All right, and let me type that in the chat room for everybody as well. So make it a little easier for them. Of course, if we also have it linked on our website,
right,
as well. But I tell you what, I have really enjoyed the book, Merlin Master of Magic. You know, again, for 190 pages, this thing has got a lot of stuff in it.
Yeah,
you learn about Merlin. There's you know, the magic behind Merlin, the magic behind the magic. You know, kind of stuff going on in it, and you know, legends and myths. You talk about associations of Merlin with that. I mean, this is a really kind of an all-inclusive little book about Merlin and what surrounds Merlin.
Right. I mean, well, thank you very much. I've tried to bring in as much as I possibly can, you know, about that particular figure, that particular person. And obviously Merlin represents, you know, one heck of a lot of stuff. And, you know, the whole world of magic is fascinating. And I think that, you know, if you look at the bibliography, for instance, you know, if you buy the book, I mean, there's plenty of stuff there that you can work off. You know, I mean, I'm not the only person who's writing about things like this. You know, there are a lot of people who wrote about Arthurian things. I mean, if I can mention a couple of names, Alan Richardson is a friend of mine, and he's, you know, he has written so many books in that era, in that area. And there is also somebody called Gareth Knight, and both of them are worth reading, along with Dion Fortune and W.G. Gray. Yeah, and Crowley, you know, mm-hmm. If you want to know about magic, read Crowley. I mean, he certainly knew about his magic.
All right.
I'm not sure he's a very nice man, to put it mildly, but he certainly knew, you know, he knew about what he was dealing with.
All right. Now, you mentioned a few times about coming over to the States and doing some speakings now. I mean, most of our listening audience definitely is U.S.-based, but we have many Canada and U.K. listeners. So where are some places that you're going to be speaking here maybe in the next few months or so?
Okay, well, I tend to center my activities in Oregon, in Portland, Oregon, That's where I am. There's a place called the New Renaissance Bookshop, though I believe you pronounce it Renaissance.
Right, yes.
and that's in Portland, and that's a big spiritual center. But go on the website, but I think you would be better off looking at that their site. Shall I repeat that one?
Yeah.
It's called NRB, or New Renaissance Bookstore in Portland, Oregon. I mean, I realize that's a long way away if you live in Massachusetts, but I mean, that I tend to center everything around there.
Well, hopefully one of these days you'll make it at least to the eastern side of the United States. So
I
can come, because Oregon's a long way away for me.
I know it. This is what's so extraordinary about it. So, I mean, you know, I live in a country that's only 150 miles wide. you know, you could drop it in the middle of Texas and nobody would notice.
Right.
I mean, apart from the Texans, I think.
All right. Well, yeah. And who knows? Maybe one day I'll make it over way.
Yeah, well, come on over. Come and visit.
Right.
Yeah,
take a holiday, right?
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. A vacation.
Yes, that's right. it would be a lot of fun. I love to travel, but I tell you what, Gordon, we got to get ready to get out of here. We've got a show that follows us. But I really appreciate you coming on. It was just a great, great discussion.
Different
things.
I enjoyed it very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Well,
thank
I appreciate it. And can you just hang on the line with me just for a minute here as I close out the show? Just hang on. Just hang tight for me, okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Well, thank you so much again, Gordon, for joining us.
Okay.
All right, everybody. That was Gordon Strong. Do check out the website there. That, of course, is www.gordonstrong.co.uk. And again, if you want to check out the book, want to learn a bit more about Merlin, that book is Merlin, Master of Magic. And, you know, I've read it over the last couple of weeks. I didn't get to read the whole thing. I'm almost done with it, maybe like 20 pages or so. But I just really, really enjoyed it. I mean, this 190 pages, this thing is packed full with information. But I tell you what, it is time for us to get out of here. The Jackal's Head is up next, live right here on Tenacity Radio. As I see the chat room starting to pile up for the Jackal crowd, so make sure to tune into that. And I want to say thanks to everyone who joined us tonight. Of course, Gordon Strong and Dina Budd, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules to share with us your thoughts, your work, your opinions, your views. Thank you so much. And now it is time for me to get out of here. I will see everybody. Well, we're not going to be broadcasting this next Sunday because it is 4th of July, It is a holiday. We're going to be taking it off, but we'll be back right after that the next week with Dr. John Turner. We're going to talk about miracles, manifestations, the afterlife, a little bit of this and that. He's going to be our guest for the entire show, so make sure to tune into that. And again, thanks everybody for joining us. This has been Shadows in the Dark, where the darkness is illuminated. Good night, everyone.
Shadows in the Dark.
The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
And if the hippies and the yippies and the disruptors of the systems will shut up,
demented spiritual experience.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley.
Okay, we've had a problem here.
E is equal MC squared.
The message is very simple. Think for yourself and question authority.